Tonight on Arena, Edwina Gukian goes dancing at the crossroads for Culture Night and celebrating 70 years of William Golding's The Lord of the Flies. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. We start this evening with film reviews, in fact. The Substance, a body horror film starring Demi Moore as a TV aerobics guru who is dropped from her slot by Dennis Quaid's nasty studio executive. You may have heard writer-director Curly Forge talking on the show about this film last Monday. Next, we have The Goldman Case, a French courtroom drama inspired by the real-life trial in 1975 of Pierre Goldman, left-wing radical who had earlier been convicted of the murder of two pharmacists during an armed robbery in the 1960s. Our third film will be Sugarcane, award-winning documentary about an appalling story we also know in this part of the world, but instead of being in Ireland, we're in Canada, the abuse of children in residential schools mostly run by the Catholic Church. And finally, Irish film is a boxing movie called Swing Bout. Tara Brady, Hilary White have been to the cinema for us. Tara's on the line. Hilary is with me now in studio. Let's start with The Substance. Demi Moore plays Elizabeth Sparkle? Yes, Elizabeth Sparkle. She's dropped from her TV slot for a younger replacement and help arrives in the form of The Substance. Let us have Dennis Quaid explain more.
Have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Younger, more beautiful, more perfect. One single injection unlocks your DNA, starting a new cellular division that will release another version of yourself. This is The Substance.
With a big foghorn warning before you take The Substance. As I say, Hilary White with me here in studio and Tara Brady joining us on the line. Demi Moore as this character of Elizabeth, who's kind of been pushed to one side. I'm sure it was something, Tara, she just simply couldn't refuse. It's too brilliant a part for her to walk away from.
Well, it's a really interesting thing about Demi Moore. If you've been keeping an eye on Demi Moore's later kind of years, she makes very interesting choices. She popped up a couple of years ago in Amanda Kramer's kind of lo-fi, very edgy crime musical, Please Baby Please. She made a Hindi language film in 2018. So she has made these kind of interesting choices in her later years. And this one is a really big swing. And for her and in terms of its script, I mean, it sounds absolutely bonkers when you hear it, because it's this chance encounter. She's got this cellular altering medication, but Coralie Forgat is such a succinct and elegant sort of film and storyteller that once you're in the world of the film, you don't question it at all. You're absolutely, well, of course she takes an injection and this births this younger version of herself played by Margaret Qualley. Well, of course they have to share the body week on and week off. What else would there be? It makes complete sense when you're watching.
Just remind us, if you would, of Coralie Forge. What kind of auteur are we talking about there, Tara? I'll come to you in a minute, Hilary.
She's a very, very interesting filmmaker. She'd made a big splash in 2017 with a rape reprisal thriller called Revenge. And that, too, was an outrageous kind of comic body horror. And it played perfectly well as a kind of gory thriller. It played very well for horror fans and aficionados. But it was also incredibly sly and cine literate, because kind of the trick to it while you were watching was that it took this character that's a kind of classic horror movie final girl and slowly evolved her into the monster over the course of the film. And that's very much similar kind of territory that we're in right now.
Tara touching there on the fact that Margaret Qualley and Demi Moore are essentially the same person, sharing the same body, even though we know they're going to look very different. And there's very much the young version of Elizabeth Sparkle, the TV guru. Do you agree with Tara that Forge manages to handle this kind of storytelling, and you just just buy into it without any questions.
I thought for the first hour there was so much control and so much style and so much intrigue to this film. And I thought that she was tackling something that is, you know, rightfully very scary that we live in the midst of, this very predatory beauty standards that exist in showbiz. And I found the way that she portrayed Elizabeth Sparkle to me more, you know, there's real sympathy you start to feel there, because she's an archetype on one hand, but at the same time, like Tara said, of course she's going to go down. She's about to be made redundant on her 50th birthday. I thought as this went on, though, and we got into the final quarter of the film,
where it really becomes a body horror, doesn't it?
It goes all out. It's body horror and some. And I thought that it really unraveled a little bit too much. It does this thing that a lot of horror films seem to do, which is for the final 20 minutes, they push the button that says more is more. And we're suddenly just being showered with prosthetics, blood, viscera. Mm. And I thought that had a smothering effect on the good work that had been done previously. Well,
and I've mentioned Dennis Quaid as a horrible executive.
Yeah, named Harvey.
Named Harvey,
this film
yes,
wasn't
yeah.
on the nose enough. Yeah. Yeah.
So it was that a bit too much on the nose for you? How did the character, mind the name, how did the character work?
I thought that kind of played in very neatly to a world that is obviously, it's recognisable on the one hand, but at the same time, it's very exaggerated. I mean, she's in a car accident in the first, the opening 20 minutes that is so wildly horrific, and she walks away unscathed. So very quickly we're saying, okay, this is a world where it looks similar, but the rules don't quite apply. So I kind of bought into that. I was okay with that.
And the other side aspect of this is there is a satirical take on the male gaze. How does Forger handle that particular side of things, Tara?
Well, I think she's very clever, like all the way along. And I mean, I understand exactly where Hillary is coming from. What I would say is that the kind of outrageousness fits the outrageousness of the ageism that underpins the movie. I mean, I presume you've come across Demi Moore talking about her own experiences in recent weeks promoting the film, and they are outrageous experiences. Yeah. So I think sort of the largesse sort of fits with that central theme of the film. I mean, I think it's very, very clever in all sorts of ways. I mean, obviously it's so grotesque, and if you're squeamish about spinal taps or tooth pulling or anything about
that, it's not
going to be a film for you.
Yeah.
But I do like the way that she turns, things like soft porn lighting. She turns things like sexist male gaze and thing, and she uses them to make this very very scathing feminist point.
And the other aspect is Demi Moore. Now Margaret Qualley, obviously they do share the screen. There's no question about that. It is, you know. You could argue that it's almost equal billing, but Demi Moore really is carrying a lot of this, Hilary. Did she work for you?
I thought she was really the main event in this film. I mean, obviously, it's one of those very inspired pieces of casting where the context of the actor we're looking at and what we know about the topography of their career is making an overlap with the character.
The themes of this.
It's a bit like what Darren Aronofsky did with Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. And it's very effective. And she really goes all out in this. And if there is going to be, if she has her day in the sun at the next award season, it'll be well worth it.
Well, Tara, were you there for the 13-minute standing ovation at Cannes where it won the best screenplay for Curly Forge?
I was indeed, and I was certainly one of the people that was with. I mean, it was a really interesting one because obviously we hear about these kind of long ovations at Venice and Cannes all the time. But, you know, it was one of those screenings where people were, you know, whooping and hollering all the way through the film, which is a very un-Cannes thing to do. And like people were very, very much on side for it. And it does suggest that it has this kind of larger audience beyond the kind of horror market that it will have a reach.
Stars from you, Tara.
It's
an easy 5 for me. I don't think you're quite there, Hillary.
I'm afraid I'm not. Sorry to disagree with you, Tara. It's 3 from me. I thought the last 20 minutes just went overboard, undid a lot of good work. And it was a long film. It was 2 hours.
All right. Yeah. Let us move on then to film number 2, The Goldman Case. Takes us back to the heady days of France in 1968. Student protests that took place all over the country. Pierre Goldman, at that time, committed 7 robberies and was convicted a year later of killing 2 people as well as the thefts. He always maintained his innocence regarding the murders, wrote a book in prison which made him a cause célèbre, and hence the retrial in 1975. And it's essentially the retrial is what we're watching here, Hilary.
Yeah, absolutely. Real docudrama immediacy with this. We are within the four walls of the courtroom for pretty much all of it. There's no soundtrack. There's no flashbacks. There is just
straightforward
people acting
drama
out of their skin, but acting in such a way that it's very naturalistic in a sense. I mean, so the protagonist that we have, Arye Vordalter, playing Pierre Goodman, he is this Jewish writer and left-wing celebre, a bit of an enfant terrible as well, very cantankerous, prone to standing up and, or maybe even just from sitting down, to you know, righteous indignation and big sort of romantic flourishes. And there's a gallery of fans who stand up and applaud every time he says something. And it's very chaotic at the start. I mean, it's not the kind of courtroom setup we're used to. There's people jumping out of their seats and shouting across the room, and the judge doesn't have a gavel. He's just slapping the table and getting absolutely nowhere, trying to bring order to the thing. And then it just under the radar, the whole thing just refines and refines and distills until the final half hour when the truth is really balancing on a knife edge, and he's very hard to get a read on, this protagonist. Yeah. And it's a super performance. It's an absolutely sizzling performance by Arye Vordalter.
And I guess part of it is not just Vordalter, but Cedric Kahn directing and Natalie Hertzberg, co-writer here, in a script, Tara, that is reconstructed from newspaper reports. So it has that feeling, as Hilary was saying, of docudrama.
Well, it is really an interesting thing. Like, one of the quirks of the French legal system is, you know, you can't get DAR transcripts like you can here. So what they've done is they've pieced it together from newspaper reports, but that gives it this real ripped from the headlines qualities. But it also, like, fits in with a certain pattern of cinema that's emerging from France at the minute. And we've had Saint-Omer, which won at Venice 2 years ago, and we had Anatomy of a Fall, which premiered in the same year in Cannes and went on to win the Palme d'Or. And of course, it shares Arthur Harari, who co-wrote Anatomy of Fall, plays Goldman's legal representative in this film. But it is very much an interrogation of what the French legal system is like. And if you have any familiarity with what Irish court proceedings look like, this, you know, French ones, and particularly in this film, seem absolutely anarchic. I mean, they're you know, the kind of the sort of impassioned speechifying, the sort of the lack of order, just seems like something out of a cartoon. And it's really fascinating that way. But it's also electrifying in another way as well, in the way that it's shot. And the camera just keeps moving around and looking at reactions and things. So you never notice, as Hilary pointed out, there's no music. It's set in apart from the opening scene, it's all set in the same four walls, and yet it feels incredibly cinematic and very thrilling.
Yeah, well, that's an amazing feat for something that could become static and courtroom drama, stage-like in some ways. Tara mentioning there, Hilary, that France was on trial as much here as Pierre Goldman was.
Yeah, it's one of the really fascinating things about this, is that he is from a Jewish background, but so is his defence counsel. Mm-hmm. They're both the children of Polish immigrant Jews who escaped the Holocaust, and the shadow of the Holocaust, of the resistance, of the war, are somehow in the courtroom. They're in the public opinion. They're deciding, should we play this card? Should we not play this card? It's there, and it seems like almost a character reference. If your parents were in the resistance, you're a good person. So it's really fascinating. It's definitely a surprise hit for me nowadays.
Right, this sounds like one that you both enjoyed. Had stars from you first, Hilary?
A five from me.
A five from you on this one. What are you saying, Tara?
Four and a half for me.
Four and a half. So you're both pretty close to, well, top marks and almost top marks. Yeah. You're not giving away two fives on the one night, I think, Tara, possibly is part of it.
The night is young.
The night is young. Okay. Sugarcane is where we're going next. To Canada, and the documentary Sugarcane, exploring the abuse of Indigenous children in hundreds of Catholic schools, and abuse that went on from the 1930s to the 1990s through one school in particular. As it happens, we've no clips for this, but a little sensitivity warning. If you are affected by the subject matter, you'll find out full information on rte.ie/helplines. And given, Tara, the recent events in this country, and not only recent by the last couple of weeks and the disclosures there, but when we look back at the last decade, 20 years, it's so difficult to even approach the subject matter of this film.
Well, I mean, it's obviously very interesting in the Irish context because of certain shared experiences, but it's also very interesting, unfortunately, from an Irish context, because we see the names of the priests that are involved at this institution, St. Joseph Mission Residential School, which is in British Columbia, and they took in First Nations children. It's a Catholic residential school, and just absolutely, we're meeting with survivors from that school, many of whom are elderly, and some of whom are not so elderly, including the co-director, Julian Brave Noisecat, because this institution was still open in as late as 1981. But you know, we're aware from the names of the priests, and we're aware from we watch Rick Gilbert, who's very touchingly still a devout Catholic, and he's a former chief. And when various headlines emerge in Canada about mass graves, like 200 unmarked graves of Indigenous children are found in another regional school, he works to protect religious icons, despite the fact, you know, he's had a DNA test and he shows up immediately 50% Irish. Yeah. So it is very difficult. We hear some really incredible stories of physical and sexual abuse. But it's framed in a very, very dignified way. There's nothing prurient about it.
Not at all.
It feels like therapy.
Yeah, and there are scenes that that are described where the children were made watch who were in these institutions, and it just beggars belief at some of the things they had to look at.
There is evil alluded to in this film, which is unspeakable, and part of you says that it's a remarkable film, and in other ways it's depressingly unremarkable, especially if you're from this country and we know about Tuam and Letterfrack and all these places.
Julian Brave Noisecat and Emily Cassie, first time directors
they're debutantes, and this is also some beautiful filmmaking in this. There's some really just beautifully judged filmmaking where they capture a community coming to terms with this, really facing up to trauma that, you know, that sort of the boil that hasn't been lanced up until now, up until this investigation is going on the grounds of this former residential school. So on one hand, there's the excavation of the potential bodies that are rumoured to be buried there, but there's also the excavation of this long-buried trauma which is inside the community.
And we're also talking here, Tara, about the whole process. We're talking about a First Nations community, references to the language is pulled away from them. The whole cultural expression is pulled away from these people as well, and assimilation, very similar to the type of things that happened in Australia. It's just depressingly familiar.
It is really interesting, and one of the things that you can see in that community is this return to that, and it's not the film doesn't make a big deal about it, but you can see that it's happening across the community. I find it, you know, quite apart from the really sort of traumatic things you hear about, there's just minutes that really, really struck me. There's an older lady, Rosalind, who talks about you going to the nuns, who tell her to go to the priest, who tell her to go to the Indian agent, and they tell her to go to the mounted police, and then she tells her dad, and then she ends up getting a beating at home because nobody wants to be the person who puts their hands up. But there's some images that have really stayed with me. Like, we see a map of Indigenous and Eskimo residential Catholic homes, and with pins in it where they were, and I really like took a deep breath because you just realise the extent of what you're talking about, and it's extraordinary,
and also the extent of what's not been talked about. That example that Tara is giving there, perfect example of the culture of silence that existed in all of these situations in this country, in Australia, and in this story that we're hearing in this documentary.
I think it's also, it is very inspiring though as well, because for all these issues and problems that the community already had, like substance abuse and disenfranchisement and all these things, and to be grappling with the trauma of that, and yet we see these amazing expressions of the customs and cultures that are alive and well, so vibrant, so colourful, the dance, the pipes, all that. It's a superb film, this.
Yeah, I'm kind of special. Loath to even talk about Stars, but yeah.
Yeah, it is a difficult one to review, but... It's just handled so beautifully and so well, And it does what it has to do. It's five for me.
Yeah, and it picked up, we should say, the prize at Sundance for, yes, for Best Documentary Feature. And from you, Tara?
Oh, yeah, easily 4.5. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And it's interesting because everybody was complaining last year that there were no American contenders in the Oscar documentary category. If this is definitely going to be there, and it's, I would say, a very easy winner.
Right, okay. And as I say, rte.ie/helplines, if any of the material discussed in that particular segment of the programme has caused you distress of any kind. Finally, Tara, you have been to see a new Irish film, Swing Bout, by Maurice O'Carroll. Swing Bout. I like the title. What is a swing bout? Excuse my ignorance of the world of boxing.
So swing bouts, it's like the kind of little ringers. They're the people who are there, you know, particularly when it's TV bill, it's the fighters that come in and do kind of mini fights in between the sort of bouts. And you might be just hanging around and then someone will tap you on the shoulder and go, right, you're up. So you might get a fight and you might not.
Yeah.
And in this case, we have this young English boxer, Tony, played by Keira Barkley, who's really tremendous in the film. And like, she literally does not have her fare home if she doesn't get a chance to fight. And so it's brilliant news when her manager, played by Sinead O'Riordan, who's fantastic as well, tells her...
Well, right, don't say what she tells her just yet, because I have that scene as a clip.
Excellent.
Yeah, this is the moment when the manager comes in to tell Tony, Emma, as you say, the manager who is here, played by, you said it to me there, Sinead, what did you say her name was? Sorry, Tara. Sinead O'Riordan. Yeah, and Keira Barkley as Tony. So Tony's sitting in the dressing room and in comes the manager with the kind of good news.
No screaming and shouting, okay? Good news. Really good news. Our fight's going out on the televised card. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we're still labelled as swing bout fighters, but Jack is guaranteeing that you girls will fight. Okay. You need to lose tonight, Tony. What? Casey says that you need to lose tonight.
He wants me to throw the fight.
Keep your voice down, okay? You need to lose and you need to go down in the second round.
No.
Listen to me.
No.
Listen to
I'm
me.
I'm sparking that
Listen
bitch,
to
Emma.
Me. Keep your voice down.
I don't fucking throw fights,
I know you
Emma.
Don't, but keep your voice down.
I'm sparking that bitch.
Listen to me.
I'm not throwing fights, Emma. I'm better than that.
I know you are. But they see something in that girl.
I bet
there.
They do. Her fucking hospital bill. Because I'm going to light her up when that bell goes, okay?
They see a star.
I'm the star. I'm going to be world champ.
Everyone's going to be world champ until the real world champ starts punching their face in.
There you go. Apologies, I meant to warn you about the language within the body of that clip. Keira Barkley as Tony and Sinead O'Riordan as her manager, Emma. I have to say, on the basis of that, certainly those two performances work a gem in that scene. Does the film overall hold together for you, Tara?
Well, I think the three women at the centre, including Vicky, who's the played by Chrissy Cronin, who Tony has to fight, are really great, and I think the film is best when it's centred on them. But like Martha Carl's kind of big, his sort of, I suppose, his big gamble is not that it's a gender flipped boxing film; it's that we don't see any boxing. And
that's a big decision for a sports movie not to show the sport, isn't it?
Yeah, and for me, that ultimately doesn't work. I mean, I know that sort of Tarantino did use that in Pulp Fiction, and you don't actually see the fight. But, you know, that segment had other places to go. I think if you know, a boxing movie ultimately stands and falls on, you know, how the fights are shot or choreographed, and you think of, like, boxing movies, you think about that final scene in the ring. And I think the fact that that doesn't come, and at a certain point you realise you're not going to get to see any fight, and you know, no, you just find yourself going, well, these are various distractions from not seeing a fight, and so I think that is an issue. I think it's a really big gamble, and I'm not sure they pull it off. But you know, there are great performances, and there's plenty of energy. Like there's a lot of kind of soapy kind of developments in the background, and there's a lot of energetic roaming around Parque Creve for the stadium where the film was shot. So there is a sense of momentum to it, certainly.
Yeah, okay. Stars as a final judgment then from you, Tara?
A three
from Tara Brady for Swing Bout. Swing Bout and Sugar Cane are in selected cinemas, while The Substance and The Goldman Case both go on general release. Tara Brady and Hilary White are reviewers on this Thursday evening. Now, Culture Night is almost upon us. It's tomorrow night, in fact. We will be broadcasting live from the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray. More of that anon. But we're not the only people obviously celebrating Culture Night, which is a nationwide event. And there's a television special on RT1 tomorrow night to be presented by Denise Chaya and features music from Villagers, Gemma Hayes, Niamh Regan with the RT Concert Orchestra, as well as a film performance from David Gray and Colm McInamara on Skellig Vihil. Much more besides. In Efrina, in County Leitrim, award-winning dancer Edwina Gukian joined forces with fiddle player Ultan O'Brien and Leitrim-based Syrian musician Mohammed Skaifin to reimagine a Dancing at the Crossroads scene. Those three, along with a host of dancers from all over Leitrim, will be banging the feet off the concrete in and around Efrina tomorrow night. Delighted that Edwina joins me now from our Sligo studio. Edwina, we spoke, in fact, it was on Culture Night last year, wasn't it, in Leitrim that we spoke about your attachment to dance and in particular to dance as associated and as a tradition in and around Leitrim itself.
That's right, Sean. Yeah, last year up in the Glens and Manor Hamilton, we had the conversation. Mm. But yeah, I've been immersed in music and dance, almost a way of life for us in Leitrim since I've been born. Everybody asks me, you know, when did you start dancing? But it was kind of growing up, you just learned to sing a song or lift a tune and dance a few steps when you were learning to walk and talk. So yeah, we're really lucky. I'm blessed in Leitrim. We have a great community of people who are really embracing dance and not having any inhibitions around it or worrying about what they might look like or if they're good enough to dance. Everybody can dance, and no more than years ago everybody danced and that's how they socialised. It didn't matter whether you were good at it or not, everybody enjoyed it.
And in terms of this, I'm wrong about saying you'll be out there tomorrow night, although I'm sure you'll be doing a bit of dancing tomorrow night. You filmed this during the summer, I believe.
We did, back in May, yeah, with beautiful weather.
The weather is super at the moment. You possibly should have waited. You know, the Irish summer, you can never predict it. However, you had, now when I say this was a dancing at the crossroads, I think it was a dancing at the T junction, which doesn't have quite the same ring off it, it has to be said.
No. Well, that's the crossroads in Efrina, everybody calls it the crossroads.
It's a T junction.
It's a T junction, yeah, but it's still the crossroads. And in Leitrim, we call those crossroads. So it's actually the place where Gralton once held Jimmy Gralton. It's the site of Jimmy Gralton's dance hall and his house. And we filmed there. That's where part of the film is down outside the front door of Jimmy Gralton's house. And then we move up to the site of where the hall once was. And then we move to the crossroads. And the crossroads was quite a significant place years ago, back in the 20s and 30s, because the crossroads dances used to be held there. And when Gralton came home from the States in the 30s again, there was a celebration. It was actually on Bonfire Night. And they had a crossroads dance there to celebrate the 23rd of June.
Of course, Jimmy Gralton was very much celebrated in the Ken Loach film Jimmy's Hall, and the Abbey show that toured around and included and played up in your neck of the woods as well. How important a figure was he, do you think, in terms of just encouraging that, the freedom of dance, not necessarily tradition dance, all kinds of dance in Leitrim?
Yeah, I think his spirit very much lives on. I feel that when we're at dancing at the crossroads, the freedom and enjoyment and just the celebration of Leitrim community, of our very diverse community, which is really what Gralton was for. He was for everyone together of the working class, all been treated fairly, you know, and living life as they should. And when we're dancing at the crossroads, which sounds really cliche sometimes, dancing at the crossroads, but it's so much more than that. It's not just dancing at the crossroads. It's people gathering together, talking to each other's neighbours that maybe they don't always make an effort to stop and talk to on the road. It's people coming together just to celebrate, all ages, all nationalities, all coming together. And that's really, I think, the spirit of Gralton living on there.
Yeah, and it wasn't always encouraged, this type of lewd behaviour. Let's listen to a little clip from Jimmy's Hall. Father Sheridan here, played by Jim Norton, comes to the dance hall and he's met there by Jimmy, played by Barry Ward, and Una, played by Simone Kirby.
Come in, Father. You're welcome.
Growlton, you come out.
It's Mr. Growlton to you, Sheridan.
Who in the hell do you think you are? Running classes in my parish without my permission.
No permission required. That's the point. We built it ourselves.
Education is the exclusive reserve of Holy Mother Church, not semi-illiterates.
Don't patronise me.
I will not have a communist on my turf defy the church.
Now days of tugging the forelock are gone.
Oh, bare arms. Hardly becomes you. Did your father know you're here, Una Dempsey?
If you'd like to enrol in our dance class, Father, you're more than welcome.
There you go. Jim Norton as Father Sheridan. Una played by Simone Kirby and Jimmy played by Barry Ward in a scene from the film Jimmy's Hall. Edwina Guckian joining me on the line this evening, remembering the dancing at the crossroads or at the T-junction that she was involved in during the summer. And I'm guessing that there was support from all parts of the community for the project that you were involved in, Edwina. But you mentioned there the multinational and multicultural nature of the event. How have you encouraged that kind of interaction between the various new communities that have sprung up in Leitrim in recent times?
Oh yeah, gosh, I don't think it's just me, it's Leitrim community in general. We're lucky that we're a very welcoming community, and when people choose to make Leitrim their home, or some people have no choice, they're placed here, we embrace everybody as they do, they embrace us and very much become part of the Leitrim community and Leitrim life, no more than Mohammed Sef Khan. He is our Leitrim man now, playing all over the world, you know, and being critically acclaimed for his amazing new album. So it's a collective, you know, force together. It's not any one person. But what we are blessed with in Leitrim is that we have a huge population of artists, and a lot of our work is about going out into the community and bringing people together. And the people who support our work then as artists are always the people who have come to Leitrim to make Leitrim their home. And then the locals get involved then, because the people who have made Leitrim their home, they're inquisitive as to what are they up to that we should be up to too. And it's bringing people together.
And so. You mentioned Mohammed Sef Khan there. To what extent did the dancing that was going on as part of the event, did it embrace different cultures of dance? I mean, we'll hear you in the clip I'm about to play. We'll hear your shoes on, I'm presuming, a wooden door, probably, of some kind. But how much did other dance traditions feed into the event?
It's just traditional Irish traditional dance. But what we focused on was the music itself is Mohammed's Kurdish music. So he starts off playing his bouzouki with the tune that he specifically picked for me from his own country. And then I dance to this percussively. Yeah. And Ultan is playing along with them. And then Ultan moves into some reels that he's been, I guess he's been digging through the archives, looking at pre-famine music associated with Leitrim. And then to finish the piece, we move back into that tune again from Mohammed.
Well, let's listen to that. What was referred to as the Leitrim wobbles. I doubt there was any wobbling going on in your part, Edwina. I'm sure it was good, steady dancing. Here we go. Go. And we can hear your feet there, Edwina Guckian, on the door. How difficult was it to, what I presume are essentially Irish steps that you were fitting in there, how difficult was it to fit into Mohammed's music?
actually really easy, really simple, because he was so connected. He really watches you as well as he's playing. But it was an extremely hot day, and I think I was maybe 7 months pregnant, so there was wobbling going on, Sean. Plenty of it. But I really enjoyed it. It was a real eye-opener for me, really, an ear-opener in regards dancing to Muhammad's music, and something that I'm looking forward to doing plenty more of.
And I know when we spoke last year too, we were talking about Sparks from the Flagstone, which is about folk traditions at different occasions of the year, very much a children's, or not a children's book. Hardly, if you were 7 months pregnant last May, you hardly have the 3 or 4 month year old, month old reading Sparks from the Flagstone just yet, have you?
Not yet. Not yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah, and you were looking at the different, I suppose, the dance traditions associated with different feasts.
Yeah, it's a celebration, really. It's a treasury of Irish folk traditions and calendar customs, and looking at how throughout the year all the different events that we bring people together to celebrate through music and song and dance, and passing that on, kind of empowering the next generation of children to take these on and not see them as something that, oh, this is what our grandparents and those really old people used to speak about, but taking them and saying, well, how can I make this happen again? How can I organise my own crossroads dance or a house dance or a cake dance or whatever? There's cures and superstitions and all sorts in it, but it's to really, you know, empower them to take it and carry it on and create new things with old traditions.
Yeah, and 2025, of course, next year marks the 90th anniversary of the Dance Halls Act, which didn't approve of dancing, that awful behaviour.
No.
Are you going to commemorate, celebrate that in any way, or maybe celebrate the ending of it?
Or I'll organise a referendum, that's what I'll do, Sean. it's still in our constitution, but yeah, it was brought in 1935 to kind of a licence, I suppose, to make it illegal to dance or gather together to dance if you didn't have this licence. So it also determined what type of dancing that you did. So any, you know, Shim Shaman or Lindy Hop was totally out of the question. And we were sticking to high call caps and the Siege of Venice. But I plan to, next year, the 90th year, I definitely plan to draw people's attention to it and maybe have a few illegal dances across Ireland.
Okay, we won't encourage it, but we will tell people about it. Listen, Edwina, lovely as always to speak with you. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Sean.
That's Edwina Guckian. And Leitrim Wobbles will feature on RTE Celebrates Culture Night on RTE One Television tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. And I'll tell you what's happening at 7 after the break. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. A plane crashes on a deserted island, leaving a group of privileged English schoolboys to survive as best they can. In no time at all, they split into tribes and they go feral. So goes the premise of The Lord of the Flies, one of the great novels of the 20th century and an astonishing debut by William Golding. The novel turns 70 this year, and to celebrate, Faber commissioned Dutch illustrator Amy de Jong to create a graphic novel from the original. Peter Murphy has been reading and looking at the new version for us, and he's with me in studio this evening. What age were you when you came to this novel? I know Amy de Jong has said that she was about 14 when she came to it, and she instantly it became her favourite novel, so it's been in her head for a long time.
I have the year 1983 or 84 in my head. And I began it. I didn't finish it. I did the same thing with 1984. I began both of them and for whatever reason didn't dig in, probably because I was too embedded with Stephen King, of whom is one of the major disciples of Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
And you can see it in The Stand. You can see it in It. We'll talk about its influence in a bit. But it's kind of funny that those were all kicking around at the same time.
Yeah, and it's hardly surprising that you should have Stephen King in there. The Lord of the Flies itself, I mean, it is a book, yes, about these English schoolboys, but it is full of savagery.
What blew me away was when I realised it was actually the first post-apocalyptic novel of the post-war years. And I hadn't realised that at the time and didn't realise that for a long time.
And explain why post-apocalyptic, because you wouldn't necessarily think of it as that. You might think of it as, oh yeah, this is a kind of a survival novel on a deserted island, and it's about how no matter what happens, we divide up into tribes and start fighting with each other.
You think it's a survival tale.
Yeah.
You think it's your classic South Pacific boys adventure tale. The manuscript, it was It was Golding's first novel. He was about 43 or 44 when he submitted it. It was sitting in the slush pile in Faber until a young editor called Charles Monteith took a look at it and rescued it. And there was an entire introductory sequence which describes the boy's evacuation from a nuclear war scenario, which he said, start on the island. So they pulled that out. And there's only really a fleeting mention at the start, and somewhere in the middle, I think Piggy mentions the bomb.
Yeah.
But this is the background. But in a weird way, by pulling that out of the novel, it's a haunting sort of backdrop to what's going on. And what Aimée de Jong is brilliant at doing is just bringing out a lot of the symbolism and the allegory that's in the actual novel.
Yeah, and of course she has the visuals to do that, which is different from the prose. But let's just remind ourselves of, I suppose, there's a triumvirate. There are three to four main characters, but certainly there are two main guys who are the heads of the both factions that end up being on the island together.
Yes, so there's Ralph, who's this sort of Apollonian, rational boy who comes across the famous conch shell and uses it to call the boys to order and to have repeated meetings throughout the first weeks, and to establish basic survival protocol. We need to erect shelters. We need to set a fire so we can signal if there's a ship going by, and all is well. But then his lieutenant Jack, who had sort of assumed the role of hunter and protector and more active, action-based character, begins to become a usurper, and he's a more Dionysian character, and a power struggle emerges. Piggy is, he kind of represents science and enlightenment. Piggy is a very intelligent, he's physically frail, he's got asthma and he's overweight and he can't see, he's blind as a bat without his glasses, but he is very intelligent. And his glasses kind of represent science and technology and progress and enlightenment. And the glasses become a crucial battleground between the opposing factions of the boys. But as the novel goes on, the factions deepen. And in much the same way as we've seen played out in The Stand and in Lost and in many other kind of island survival tales, you don't have a story unless you have conflict. And boy, do we have conflict here. Jack's followers are more given to superstition. They manifest this kind of supernatural apparition called the Beast, which Jack then uses in the way of warlords immemorial as a bogeyman to spur the boys onto a defensive platform.
And also to create fear. And therefore, he is the man who's in charge here. And you know, don't have to be afraid when I'm around.
He's the strong arm. He's still there in Putin. He's there all over the world.
So what we have is the rationalists with the character of Ralph, and the fundamentalists with the character of Jack.
The rationalists who stand for order and to get off this damn island as well. And the fundamentalists who are given to violence and hunting and bloodshed. And the more they go down that path, the more they lose sight of the thought of ever escaping from here.
So that's the William Golding novel, and then Aimée de Jong has taken it to give us a graphic novel. Given that it's on an island, there's a very famous killing of a pig on this, where they slit the pig's throat open, and it's described in vivid detail in the Golding prose. It sounds as if it is something that is made for a graphic novel, but I'm wondering at what age group is the graphic novel pitched?
It's a really good question, because at what age should we have read the novel in the first place? And there's many novels. Should we have read Wuthering Heights at the age we did? That's a supremely psychologically creepy story. And the general rule is let kids decide for themselves what makes them uncomfortable. I would say this is a brilliant introduction to Golding's novel.
The graphic novel is.
And I remember having a conversation with Aideen, the librarian in my old alma mater, the vocational school in Enniscorthy. And I remember her quizzing me about the right graphic novels that she could give to get boys to read, because it's a brilliant transitional phase between movies and action stories and actual novels. It should be said that Imelda Young, she was born in 1988. She encountered this at the age of 14. It became her favourite novel. There's a danger when artists are too sympathetic or too faithful to the original material. I think Zack Snyder's version of Watchmen, the film version of Watchmen, fell very much foul of that. It was almost too in awe of Alan Moore's graphic novel. This seems to work because she has absorbed the DNA of the novel so deeply that she knows what's important about it and what to be faithful to. So I think all the text is lifted verbatim from the novel, but she has let her vision go towards what the boys look like. And I would say the most important thing about the graphic novel is its journey from the rational, from the clearer cut lines and the sort of daylight comfort, idyllic nature of the island into a hallucinatory horror story.
Yeah, which is the way the prose novel goes as well. And in fact, when I was looking at the early sections of the graphic novel, I thought, you know, this is only like a slightly older version of We're Going on a Bear Hunt. It's that type of colouring. It's that type of colour palette. And, it's quite genteel.
Yes.
In the beginning.
In the beginning. And if you compare it with the novel, the boys' language in the beginning is very plummy and very public school and home counties. And they become more and more tribalistic and more and more more savage and primal as the book goes on. I read it. I read the graphic novel at the same time as rereading the text novel, and I'd read a chapter of text and then a chapter of images.
Good way to do it.
So it is really a good way to do it, because you get an appreciation for how much it's evident that she deeply, deeply loves this book.
So there are two aspects that I wondered about in the graphic, because yes, it starts with those genteel pictures, just as the novel does in prose. But we do have the beginnings start to come when Jack and his pals start to put mud and paint on their face. They're constantly chasing this little suckling pig. They see a whole set of herd of pigs and think, we want meat. They are mad for meat. And they'd kill a suckling pig, slit its throat. And that's described in great detail by Golding. How does it look on the graphic novel's page?
Blood red. She doesn't spare anybody's feelings there. This is this section, I would say, it's the kernel of the novel. It's kind of Golding's genius, whether he plotted this or stumbled upon it intuitively. It's the boys being blooded. And if you read both the text version and the graphic novel of that sequence, where they first kill a sow, and they kill a suckling sow. It's not a boar. So, and the manner in which they kill it is so horrific that you begin to divine that this is a sadistic act. This is not just a survival. This is not just for meat. This is a ritual. And they've begun to descend into the heart of darkness. Heart of darkness is invoked in the closing passages of the books.
Yeah, and I suppose it is kind of the child of the heart of darkness, it's the father of many other novels that followed.
It is. It's an indictment of post-colonialism. And in the backdrop of the whole thing is that these boys are just the creation of the society that cast them away.
There is one other aspect, just in terms of the visuals. There is the beast that Jack keeps referring to, the fear that he puts into all of the young boys. The beast can be described, it can be spoken about in prose. She had to make a decision whether to actually illustrate that and make it something on the page, or whether to leave it as something shadowy. How does she go about that in the graphic novel?
She plumbed for the rational. She decided to. It's quite impressionistic in the novel, and you can kind of flit in and out of the surreal and the real. In this, she had to make a decision, so she portrays the beast, what it actually is in clear daylight horror terms. But what she does do is, as the beast begins to, shall we say, disintegrate and degenerate, it becomes the same as the boars, it becomes a grotesque feature, and And actually what the beast is, and I won't give it away, but what the beast is horrific enough in real life in terms of the boys, in terms of the character of Simon who comes across it. Simon is a fascinating character. He's on the rational side, but he's actually kind of a mystic.
There's kind of a spiritual aspect. There's a Jesus Christ aspect to him.
Or more John the Apostle, more the poetic sort of sensitive, intuitive type.
Do we get the gory quality? Because, you know, not every character will survive to the end of Golding's novel. Is there anything sanitized? Do we get all of the full darkness of the novel in the graphic novel?
Yeah, we do. In a funny way, and in a way that doesn't seem gratuitous or won't make you flinch if you open up the book randomly. But I mean, what happens in the story is heartbreaking enough. If you can imagine that all she was doing is playing a song in a different medium. She knows this song very well and knows expertly how to transpose it into another medium. And it is a tragedy. It's a tragedy about the nature of humankind.
And I must say, the way you read it to me sounds like the way to do it. Read a chapter of Golding, look at a chapter of the graphic novel, and you'll get a lot from it.
Yes, if only to rediscover the book in tandem with the new envisioning of it. This is a beautiful artefact. I would recommend it to anyone.
And that's Peter Murphy speaking to us about Lord of the Flies, the graphic novel by William Golding, adapted and illustrated by Amy de Jong and published by Faber. And leaving me some time to tell you about our own celebrations for Culture Night tomorrow night. Of course, many people will be out and about and will be going around the city centre and the town centre and in their own communities to attend whatever events that are happening there, and make sure to check it out on culturenight.ie for your own particular area. But when you're going around, you can have us in your ear if you so wish. We are in the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray celebrating Culture Night tomorrow night, a live broadcast from Bray. Now, the tickets are all sold out at the moment, but of course you can listen to us here on RTE Radio 1 as usual from 7. Real treat in store for you there. We'll be joined on the night by, among others, musicians John Spillane, junior brother, and Susan O'Neill. Susan O'Neill with the new album, John Spillane, with that kind of Celtic opera that he's put together that we played some of last week, and junior brother with his inimitable voice will be there as well. We'll be speaking with filmmaker Alan Ginsellan as well as part of that evening. So lots in store if you want to tune in tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. But that is our lot for this Thursday. Paula Shields researched this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound here in Dublin, and John Doyle in Sligo. It was Reg Luby who produced tonight's programme. I will speak to you live from the Mermaid Arts Centre tomorrow night. John Creedon will be with you after the news.